Oceana Sawyer and I talk death. It has been her work as an end-of-life doula to help people make that transition from the realm of the living into what lies beyond what we can see, hear, feel, taste, smell, and think. She views her work as that of a truth purveyor. And while many view death as something to fear or to dread, Oceana has a different perspective. She says, anything's possible between the what was and what's becoming. It can be a very generative space, she says, because you're no longer constrained by what was. She also points out that every transition we make in life is a death and an opportunity to ask ourselves, what do we still have to offer? Far from being something fearful, Oceana views death as an extension, a reflection of the life we have lived.
Hello, and welcome to At the Podium with me, Patrick Huey. At the Podium is a multimedia platform that brings together people from a diverse background of lives, careers, and experiences who all share one thing in common. They have stepped fully into the transformative power of finding and raising their voices to make an impact on the world we live in today. At the Podium holds a space for everyone to share their stories, to be heard, and to bring us inspiration. Today, I am thrilled to share the podium with Oceana Sawyer. Oceana is an end-of-life doula. Drawing upon her meditation practices and an intensive study in the expressive arts and integral counseling psychology, she brings a grounded, compassionate presence to the death, dying, and grieving process. In addition to being a certified funeral celebrant, she is also authorized to facilitate living funeral ceremonies. Additionally, she had a previous career in corporate training and organizational development at Hewlett-Packard, as well as Levi Strauss and Company. Currently, her work is focused on grief and transformation for people on the social margins, as well as team development. Oceana holds a BA in political science and a Master of Science in training and organizational development. Oceana, welcome to At the Podium.
Oh, thank you so much, Patrick. It is such a joy to be here with you.
I am so happy that you are sitting down with me today. I just read your book, Life, Death, Grief, and the Possibility of Pleasure. And it was not a long book, but it was an impactful book. You put into those 80 pages, truth, life, and food for the road. The road that we're on together and the road as we transition out of this current form, this life that we're in. And there was something in the book that you wrote, and I'm going to quote it so I get it right. You said, this sensation of being with difficult emotions, I came to realize truly is the body at its holiest, at its realest, at its truest, and thus at its most pleasured. For pleasure, as I'm defining it, doesn't exclude pain. Rather, true pleasure is the conscious, felt integration of every emotion through the body. And those emotions very much include the large, difficult, and most painful ones, the ones we most want to push away. And then you say, what people want at the end of their lives is to truly be seen.
Yes. The space of the end of life is so special. You know, the work I do as an end-of-life doula, which is essentially a role that is associated with the person who is actually dying, no one else, just the person who's dying. And the job in that role is to make sure that they are having the kind of death that they want to have. That's it. That's all there is. And I say that's all there is, but and that's a lot, because mostly in a dying experience, you know, the team includes, you know, the physicians, the, you know, the palliative care folks who are managing comfort, the hospice people who are, you know, making sure that there's enough care for the person. And that then there's the financial advisors who are making sure you have all your stuff in order, all your papers, all your, you know, financial, your will. And, you know, there's a religious, you know, the spiritual advisor who's taking care of your soul. And then you have your caregivers who are also making sure that you're just comfortable and your basic needs are being met. And then there's the family who's like just there grieving and having their own big experience around this. So there is not one person who is just attending to the wishes of the person who's dying. Is this what you want to have happen? Would you like to have something else happen? Particularly when the person can no longer speak, to have someone who's like, no, we had a conversation and this is what I know that they would like to have happen. So hopefully it's in writing. Typically that's what it is. But so the role of the doula, the end of life doula, the death doula, is to just hold space for the person. And so can you read that last line again from that quote?
You said what people want at the end of their lives is to be truly seen.
Yes. So that is what the doula does, is to make sure that they are seen. And it's such a special space, as I was trying to say earlier. It's like, I like to say in active dying, a portal opens up and you can feel it. People who've been with someone who's dying, and maybe you have, you can feel there's something that shifts a little bit in the time and the space, actually. Things slow way down. And it's almost like a timeless space. You're kind of moving in a bit of slow motion. And so in that particular portal that opens up, it's sort of like also a space that strips away all of the pretense. And so what you want to have at the end there is the truth. What the space calls for is really just what's true. So a lot of that performative stuff, and you can feel it. I know I have, as the person attending someone who's dying, you know, the family members come in with all of this hysteria and melodrama. And, you know, you can feel if that's real or if it's just them performing. And the person who's dying, really what they want is to have that space as clear as possible of this extraneous stuff that's not really relevant, so that they can like transition out of their body. I like to say transition out clean, transition out smoothly. What there is to do in those spaces is just be real. That's why that sentence is there. It's really about seeing the person who's dying well enough that you are just there witnessing them as they transition out of the body. And if you can be there in a space of love and care, great, but that's not even required. What's required is something true. The truth is really what is, I think, required at the end of life.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone talk about the transition that a person makes when they pass, when they die, as a moment of truth, a moment of awakening for that person. Because in the book, you describe that when a person is passing, the body starts to move. And that person asserts in the book that that is the person actually leaving the body, but also freeing themselves of the pain, the sickness, the encumbrance, the things that encumber their body while they were sick. And I think she was referring to a person in the book who was an ice skater, perhaps, or a dancer, and that as they were passing, they were re-finding that space within themselves where that movement happened, which is really a beautiful moment of truth.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you're bringing that particular story. That was Melanie DeMore's sister, Drina. And that piece of the book is where I'm talking about the last sense that goes is the sense of hearing. Let me just back into that a little bit. So the book is about dying and grief in the context of sensuality. And I'm talking about sensuality in this particular case in the form of the senses. So all five of your senses, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, hearing, and your sixth sense, which would be your ability to have thoughts. People like to call it intuition, but it's thoughts, it's memories. It's intuition also. So the last sense to go, you know, your body as it's, breaking down on its way out, you know, your senses start falling away. And the last sense that remains is your sense of hearing. And Melanie is a singer. And so what she did at the bedside of her sister who was dying was she sang for 5 days straight. She just sang. And in this singing, you know, this, oh gosh, there's so much to say about this because, you know, this is one of the aspects, this is one of the central aspects you can bring in at the end of life. You know, this piece around the hearing, and you can play music. Certainly I did that for both of my parents when they died. I played, you know, some of their favorite music. That's a way to bring in a sensory experience to sort of ease a person out of their body. You don't have to do, I mean, hopefully they're already comfortable. You know, they have adequate medication. So they're, you know, in as little pain as possible. That's basic comfort care. That should just happen. But on top of that, you can then add these pieces of delight, of joy that sort of elevate the experience. And so playing music is one way to do that. But Melanie sang. And this human voice, you know, in this particular case, a familiar human voice, actually like a lullaby, you know, singing you out, enabled the person who was dying, in this case, her sister, to sort of like release all of that, those earthly mental constructs they had about their limitations. So in this case, Drina was dying of multiple sclerosis, MS. So that, you know, in a really severe case, I mean, very crippled the last years of her life. But in the dying now, that falls away. And now she's like moving to the music. Mm. And it creates this moment of magic and miracle that becomes available because Melanie has attended to the space, this liminal space where you're not quite dead and you're no longer really alive. Mm. So you're no longer really living and you're not dead. And there's this liminal space. Again, the portal, this special portal that opens up where honestly, it's a mystery and anything's possible. So attending to beauty or anything that can make a person feel even better as they are on their way out, because make no mistake about it, dying is hard. It's hard work. It might be the hardest thing you do in your life is the actual physical act of dying. Now, we give people all kinds of medications to ease the physical discomfort of dying, but it's hard. And it takes, you know, a certain amount of intention, really, to do it. So, yeah, that's a great story around what becomes available when you are really tending to the journey of a life, ending a life well. And in this particular case, using song as a way to bring in some joy, some pleasure into the process.
You just said so much that touched me. In the book, you use the word pleasure and sensuality a lot when describing the work, the process of death and dying and the work that you do. And having you talk about this experience with Drina made me understand more fully what you meant when you used those words in the book. Those are very specific word choices that you made. And I know that you're a highly educated person with a master's and a bachelor's in political science and an MS in organizational development, I believe.
Yes, and counseling psychology.
Yes. So I know word choice is very specific for you. It's not just happenstance that you use those words. And I wondered why you wanted to marry what those words can mean with death, which in many ways people don't view as a pleasurable experience. They view it as a very sad and grief-filled experience.
Oh, I'm so glad you're asking this question, and just the way you're asking it too, because I know this is a podcast, but if you could see my face when...
Oh, you're on camera.
Those questions.
You're on camera.
I was just like, ooh, yeah. I just got this, you know, really mischievous look around. Yes, I chose those words very particularly because in a sense, I wanted to trouble them, you know, just like, you know, poke at them a little bit and in truth, expand them, because sensuality is so often equated with sexuality. And then you put in pleasure and now you're talking about pornography. But really what I want to do here is expand these notions of pleasure. I want to like bring pleasure back from the realm of pornography and make it available to more of us. And so I'm talking about pleasure here very simply, but more expansively as something that actually just simply feels good to you. And you are the arbiter of what that is. Something that feels good to you may not feel good to me. And how do you know when something feels good? Well, you simply use your attention. You take your ability to think thoughts and to perceive your universe through your five senses, you know, sight, sound. And so you're perceiving your world. And then you put your attention on one thing, for instance. Like right now, I'm looking out the window at the pine trees that are just outside my window. And they are very lush green because it rained a little bit this morning. And now they're just even, the color is even more vibrant. So I put my attention there. And because I'm actually being explicit about that and deliberate about that, it's something that's adding to the pleasure of the moment, the pleasure of me talking to you. I'm looking at your smile here on camera and I notice that, and that feels good to me. So I have added in my attention, like I noticed you, but what I also added in is that what I call the secret sauce, which is approval. Okay. So now I see it. I like it, and I am actively approving of it. And now I have pleasure. I have something I can lean into that is pleasurable to me. So, and that's not a static thing, right? And I talk about this a lot in the book. It's not static. What's pleasurable this moment may not be pleasurable the next moment. And what's pleasurable in this moment could be even more pleasurable, you know, in the next moment, because now I'm adding in more approval. And then that will ebb, you know, just like all life has an ebb and a flow to it. It builds and then it recedes. And so that is one of the goals of the book is to really have people see how, unlike, let's say, in a capitalist structure where, you know, grind culture, right? Where the idea is just to make more stuff. Just, you know, stay on the treadmill, make more stuff, get more money, buy more stuff, make more stuff. You know, it's all about increasing the amount of stuff in the world. And what I'm advocating is a return to actual life, which has a, you know, an ebb and a flow. It's dynamic. It builds and it recedes. So, and that's just what we're doing. Yeah. In any case, whether you call it that or not, we are living. And we come up against moments where we're receding, we get sick, so we're receding, and then we get better and we're living again. And then we will die. You know, nobody's getting out of this alive.
Nobody.
But we're all on a trajectory that's going to end in, you know, death. And so what I wanted to do with this idea around sensuality and pleasure is to bring the dying process back into the living, the land of the living. Because really, another way to look at this is that you are living all the way up until that moment when you are not. You know, your body just stops functioning altogether. Mm. And there's some science around this. You know, it takes a while for a nervous system to, you know, quiet down the electrical impulses in your body. And that, you know, takes a while, even after you're functionally dead. Mm. But the point is that you are living all the way up until you're dying. And, you know, so often people want to do this move in the dying process around, no, I'm going to fight. Mm. I'm going to fight to live, you know, and they think that's living. Well, what you're actually doing is you're now in the fight. And now you're in the capitalist structure of, you know, you got to keep going. So you're fighting, when you could be in the living, which is the recognition that your body is breaking down. And if you turn towards the actual now, the body breaking down, what is still living, then there's a kind of a grace that enters there. You know, traditional cultures know about this. They know how to recognize, okay, my time is coming to an end. And what do I want to do with the remaining time? They pass on instructions and information and acknowledgements to their loved ones because they know, okay, this is it. I'm winding it down. It was a good life. You know, there's a life review that happens. I did this, I accomplished that, and I did this, and I did that, and okay, I didn't get to that, but you know what? At this point, it doesn't matter, you know? And that's another thing that happens, by the way, at the end, is there are some people who have regrets at the end, and, oh, I wish I had done, you know, all this stuff, and then they really get down to the very end, and it doesn't matter. Now it's just, okay, I'm going into the, you know, whatever I'm going, whatever your beliefs are about that. But here's the thing about paying attention to your death as you're living is that you could know what those regrets would be. For instance, one of the things that I know, I don't want to die before I reclaim my relationship with one of my cousins. And so rather than get on my deathbed and go, man, I wish I had really like gotten a chance to say to Penny, like, I have always really valued you. I know we were in competition through most of our childhood, but I always admired you. I would like for her to know that now.
She's going to know it when she hears this.
Right, exactly. In fact, I should make sure that Penny hears this, because Penny, I love you. You're my cousin and you're like so badass. Ooh. And those are the kinds of things you can do if you have your death in mind as you're living. And it's not morbid. People think, I don't want to think about my death. Oh, here's the thing, right? People think if they even think about their death, it invites it in. Oh, that, you know, this is superstition. If I even think about death, it might happen. Like,
yeah,
it's like if you think about sex, you're not going to get pregnant. You know, it's the same thing. If you think about your dying, you're not going to die. You know, that's not going to be the reason you die. I guarantee you. You might die. You might be thinking about your death because you may somewhere in your body already know that you have a life-threatening disease going on in there, which is another interesting thing, by the way. A lot of people already know they're dying before they get a diagnosis. Yeah, they know something's off. Yeah.
You brought up something twice in your response. You talked about the capitalistic society. As I was reading the book, you identify the root problem of death for our current culture being that we try to apply the theoretic economic principles of capitalism to the real biological, the word you used, ebbs and flows, that we and the expiration of life itself that happens with living beings. And that we're trying to control the life and death experience the way we want to control our economic markets and institutions. And I'm wondering if you think that is really the big lie about death that we have to sort of move past and to go into that sense of death is a function of nature. It's not something that can be fought, as you said earlier, controlled, perhaps made better and alleviated by the need for pleasure in that process for the person who's in that transition. But I wonder if our relationship to economics and how we want to control that impact our ability to even fathom death.
Yeah. Yeah. Would I call it the big lie? Yeah, maybe. I do feel like a lot of our conditioning is around, you know, we are brought up to be good functioning members of the workforce. You know, that's what our whole education is about, from kindergarten through high school. And then we go to college only so we can get a job and so we can be better participants in the, you know, workforce, which is another way of saying better participants in the economic system. So we have that conditioning. And I think what in the absence of any other type of cultural training, which our, you know, dominant culture, you know, tends to erase, has erased all of that from all of us. You know, I don't have access or much access to my cultural ways from the African diaspora, which I just found out in a death cafe, which I host every week, that I had someone in there from Kenya, literally, who talked about the death ways that were being, you know, colonized out of even her little village. Around when people are dying, they take them to the forest and there's a caretaker that goes with them to the forest until they are dead. Mm. And, you know, they're doing the prayers, the, you know, anointments, you know, whatever songs. And then when the person dies, they dismember them in a very particular way so that the forest can consume them. And then people are used to moving in the forest and coming across bones and body parts because that's just a part of the culture. There's nothing morbid about it. It's just, oh, they're so-and-so decaying. Okay. Their spirit has gone on to wherever it has, you know, whatever their traditions are. But my point is that now that's stripped out of modern culture and we're left to only be about how are we going to make the next buck. If we can expand our point of view about living to include this very natural body that we all exist in, right? The yeah. very natural body and how to really be more embodied in life so that you can be with your body as it's dying. And that's just an opportunity for a fuller, I think, richer lived experience. I don't know if I answered your question, but
you did. And I think part of it ties to, because you say in the book that culturally we have a challenge with death because we don't know how to value life. My first question and your answer somehow embodies that concept that if you're going to have a good death, you should have a good life. And that you can't interact with death if you don't know how to interact with life. Because it's part of the same thread that we're pulling. It's not a different thread. And if you can't value your life, then how would you value your death or someone else's death? And that troubles me, and if I'm being completely honest with you, because in many ways, I fear the cessation of life. And so to think about death, which we must, makes me nervous. It makes me scared. I think that's why I'm afraid of the dark. And you talk about this in your book, that we live in a culture that is afraid of the dark. And we may have a perception of death as darkness. And that may be part of why I fear the dark. But there's, I think what you're saying is really profound. I'm just trying to work through it with you, my feelings about what you're saying. And because I think you're absolutely onto something there.
Can I jump in here?
Yes.
Okay. Because you said something I've never really quite thought about before, but this conversation is bringing it up for me. You said that you fear the cessation of life. And when you said that, what I recognized was it's because you don't have any stories about it. You don't know. No one has told you what happens when a body dies. No one has told you what's going to happen to you when you die. So it is a mystery. It is unknown. And the unknown is scary, necessarily. Now, if you were living in a different culture, you would be told stories. In fact, you would be with grandma when they died, and there would be someone telling you, so now grandma is dying, and this is why she's dying. And when she dies, her spirit is going to go here. You know, her spirit's going to go to heaven, or her spirit's going to go, you know, to wherever. You know, you would have a story about that. And because you were there witnessing it, you would see how, you know, the caregivers tended to her and eased her way. And you would probably be there at the end where she smiled and said, I love you all. It's been a good life. And then closed her eyes and left. You would not have any fear about that because you would be there. So one of the things that I think is happening in our culture is that we don't have the stories, we don't have the lived experience of actually being with dying. And that's because it happens in hospitals. You know, it happens in institutions. We want to like say, can somebody else take care of this? Honestly, just kind of the way we are with almost everything. We're that way with our food. You have no idea where your chicken came from, how it lived, how it died, how it got to be in the package. We don't want to know.
Yeah.
Because we know it's bad. We feel the same way about dying, but you know what? It doesn't have to be that way. Just because it is a priori doesn't mean that it has to go on being that way. So I think the more that we can just pay attention to the full life cycle, which includes dying and all the ways of dying. And then you said something else very interesting, which is we are afraid of the dark, which I say in the book. And I know what I mean when I say afraid of the dark. And one of them is, of course, the absence of light. But that's also a metaphor, right? It's also all the ways that, culturally speaking, we cannot deal with darkness. We can't deal with dark people. We can't deal with dark places. We can't deal with dark truths. There's all this way in which we just want to be in the light, in the easy, in the, as if light equates to easy, by the way. I don't even want to make that comparison, but we have these cultural mores around that. And what it does is it has us living in this very monochromatic life, when we could be living a technicolor life that includes all the colors, all the temperatures, all the gradations of light to dark. It's what we were meant for. We were actually built for that. And you know how we know that is because of the rise of mental, you know, disorders. We're not coping with this monochromatic plan that has been handed to us. We're not coping with it very well. And people who are more distanced from the cultural ideal, you know, of whiteness, know that for real, for real.
Yeah.
So I bring back the dark.
In all ways.
Exactly.
In the book, Oceana, you talk about the between space between here and the space there, here and there. And I wonder, for you, what is that in between space?
Yeah, I've talked about it a little bit earlier. It's called liminal space. It's actually, there's a word for it. Liminal space is literally the in between the there, the here and the there. And I would like to posit that liminal space between the what was and what's becoming is potent space. As I alluded to earlier, anything's possible between the what was and what's becoming. and you have an opportunity in this in-between space, which is what I call grieving. You know, you've lost your person and your life has changed, but you don't yet have this new life without this person. You're sort of in between. And this in-between liminal space has so much potential.
Mm.
If we are willing to be with the darkness, which can be a rich space. You know, if you hang in it long enough, you can become aware of its textures, its colors, its information,
wow.
Its wisdom. It's there in this space where it's kind of quiet. You know, there's enough that's not there, you know, that you could actually start to create and imagine what would you want to be there. It can be a very generative space because you're not constrained anymore by what was.
Right. You have helped people pass on dying. What has that taught you about life?
No one's ever asked me that question. Probably because I spend too much time talking to people in the death trade. Oh, God, it's so much. It's crazy how much. I would say the biggest thing, the most potent thing, has been that there is so much more available than my tightly held beliefs would have me have. If I can loosen my attachment to those beliefs and just hold them a little lighter, because that's what you do in a dying process, you know, when you're with somebody, you're just letting go. And that space of letting go of those attachments, there's so much expansion and space to create in there. That's my big takeaway from being with the dying, is how much actual real space is available without all the attachments. And the attachments are arbitrary. We just made them up, you know, or we took on what was handed down to us. But you can see when people are dying how not real they are, you know. They just really don't matter at that point.
You grew up in suburban Los Angeles, middle class Los Angeles. You had a job in corporate America. Was that a death, leaving corporate America into this new life for you?
Oh, yes. And see, that's the thing. I'm so glad you asked that question, because I think people don't realize that they're having little deaths all along the way. Mostly you want to just run away from them, you know, get past them as quickly as possible, because we think that's what a healthy, functional person does, is say, okay, that's over. And I'm going to move on to the next thing, you know, mm-hmm. as quickly as possible. And really what the opportunity is to actually be with that loss, you know, maybe just spend a little bit of time with that loss, you know, grieve it, mourn it, bury it, do the things to really just honor. And see, and that's kind of what it comes down to, is by honoring these losses, you are actually honoring your good life. And what could be better than more honor, more acknowledgement, more richness, more love? More love. And that's what comes from acknowledging the losses, is you can also say, you can acknowledge that you loved a thing or you liked it, and now it's no more. And that's okay. You're taking what you learned. You're taking the wisdom, you're taking the good that it provided, and you're going to take that good and use it now for the next phase. You know, leaving my corporate job, was certainly a death. My identity was all tied up in my job. And so I entered a long phase where I had to create a new identity. But I took the good stuff with me. I took all of the skills that brought me joy. I certainly took the money. That was good to have, you know, to get me through to the next thing. And that's worth acknowledging.
Yeah.
You know, see how we're like laughing and there's delight there? That little delight, I'm taking that with me. And I'm bringing it into this next thing that I'm doing. Honoring transitions is, I think, a lost art. And I think it can really provide so much more depth, more knowing, more information, more fuel for the things we are creating. I happen to know that at Google, they have a brilliant, I don't know if she would call herself a priestess, but she's in the HR function, and she holds a space annually at Google where they have a funeral for the projects that didn't work. You know, the ideas that never got off the ground, or the ideas or the projects that had a natural end, like they had a life and now that life cycle is ending. And so we're putting them to bed or, you know, in the ground. They literally have a living funeral ceremony for all the things that didn't work and or are done. And they end them. They close the cycle. One of the big ahas I got once with one of my teachers was in the sensuality education path that I pursued was anybody can start a cycle, but the person who can end a cycle has the power of the cycle. So mostly we don't know how to end things in our culture, but the power to end something well is you claiming the juice, the energy, the power that was in that cycle. You get to take that with you by ending it, by claiming it done. And now you can go on with the good stuff from that.
In this season of the show, I was really interested in talking to people who have found their voice and are using that platform, the book they write, the song they sing, the TV show they're on, to impact the world, impact their community. I wonder for you if you have found your voice, and if you have, or if you're in that process, what you are saying with it or hope to say with it.
I just turned 60. And I'm claiming eldership. I am. And it's been a year. When I turned 59, I had been thinking about my 60th birthday as a moment, right? It doesn't have to be for everyone. I just claimed it for myself. But the entire year, I really thought about and sat with, what am I taking with me? In all this time on the planet, what's actually really mine? What are my gifts? As I wind down certain presence in the world, what do I have still to offer? And I feel like it is my knowing, my words, my voice to share the things I know or have come to know. And in the process of doing that, more so, but to create space for people, other voices to come and be in that weaving of voices. Like I see it as a tapestry. And I see it very much as if I say my truth. Because now, you know, at this age, what do I have to lose, right? Not too much. So I'm just like saying my truth all over the place. Yeah. So by saying my truth, though, you know this. Everybody knows this. When someone tells the truth, it opens up space for other people to tell their truth. And that's really all I'm about right now. It's like, not all, but a lot of what I'm about is I want to hear truth. I want to see the weaving of truth. And even if they're oppositional, which so many things are really not at the bottom, But, you know, what is this? What is the truth? And how does that generate more life?
Oceana, thank you so much for your time today. I'm so grateful. I had no idea what to expect, but you're touching the mystic chords of humanity, your work. And I appreciate that very much. So thank you for this time today.
I really have to acknowledge you as well for creating a space for more truth to be told. I said things today I have not said out loud before, and that is a testament to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Oceana. To those of you who are watching or listening, remember, we all have a voice. Use yours wisely. Thank you, Oceana, and I hope Penny sees this.
Me too.
Bye, everyone.